Welcome back to the UCB Theater Podcast. Sitting across from me is Will Hines.
That's funny, because sitting across from me is John Frusciante.
How crazy. Yeah, right. We are back with the UCB Theater
Why
Podcast.
Why were we gone so long, John?
I fucking don't know, but goddammit, I'm sorry. I'm so frustrated by
you
it.
You really are upset.
I really
about
am.
It.
I feel like we start. I told you this yesterday.
Yeah.
That we started this great thing.
Yeah.
Built it up.
Went and way then, better than we had expected.
Oh, yeah. And then fucking abandoned.
And it, for no reason.
Just because we're lazy.
We're lazy.
This goes back to those success instincts that we have that you and I were talking about yesterday.
Oh, that's the awesome success instincts?
Mm-hmm.
That every decision we make will surely lead us to great success.
Yes.
That's what we're always attracted to. Yeah, that's right.
But
well, I'm glad we're back.
Me
you
too.
You don't have to overly self-punish.
Okay, well, I won't. But we're going to do more of these in 2011. And,
yeah, I think we're going to do these on a regular basis, we think, for real.
We made an agreement to do these every Thursday.
Okay, great.
So, oh, speaking of which, I can't be here next Thursday.
Hilarious. Well, today we have a great guest to start off our return to the podcast with, and that is Mr. Michael Delaney. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Will. Hello, John.
Thank Hello.
You for being here.
My yeah. pleasure.
So once we, we're going to get into a bunch of stuff today, Delaney. We're going to talk. I don't know what we'll actually get to, but what I'm hoping we get to is a little memory lane,
okay.
How you got into improv, early UCB days,
mm-hmm.
early Swarm stuff.
Yeah.
A little Delaney nerd theory, like stuff you tend to like to go over in class and stuff that is fun for you to do. We'll see wherever that leads us. Maybe I'll bring up some particular shows in the past that I've liked. I don't know if we'll get to that. And John's got a bunch of stuff written down. So we have a lot we
just
could
potential notes and things.
Talk about, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We've got
Before
plenty.
We do that, is there any actual business we have to do? We've abandoned all practical
Oh, yeah. We've abandoned that. Everybody universally agrees that that's unnecessary.
Because okay, right. So
go to the UCB Theater website and go to shows.
Okay, great.
But, you know, it's hard to skip stuff. I've heard your podcast. It's hard to skip ahead.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
You have to sit and endure through us talking about whatever shows are on Thursday of a month before it was actually published.
Right.
Yeah, it makes the listener feel a little bit like he's being held hostage.
Well, that's our goal, is to hold everybody hostage to our opinions and our information.
It's our dream.
You've done well.
Well, wait, you want to start this?
Yeah, sure. So just give us background on how you got into
How'd you get into improv?
Yeah, how'd you get into improv?
Improv, I guess kind of inspired by Second City. I started improvising in the late 80s, and there wasn't a lot of improv around. I'd only seen it a handful of times.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ham-handedly interrupt you right now.
Yeah.
Because I realized something that I wanted to do that I didn't do with Billy. Just explain to people a brief bio of Delaney.
Okay.
I'm going to do this, and then you start over from the beginning. So Delaney is a member of the Stepfathers, one of the senior teachers at the UCB School in New York, has been one of the top teachers pretty much since the UCB themselves stopped teaching classes. Delaney was one of the first ones to take over. You can correct me the details when we get back to it. Was a founding member of the Swarm, universally heralded as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, improv teams ever to be at this theater.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Been in a million great shows here, and have been like the sort of guru in residence, teacher to be admired and feared, crotchety and beloved Delaney. A lot of people have Delaney stories of like Delaney classes they take where they were either terrified of you or like found it to be the greatest thing ever, or both at once. And we'll talk about that when we get to it.
It's making me perspire.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just trying to give people who maybe don't know you as well as the super improv nerds a little perspective. You don't have to agree or disagree with anything I'm saying. That's that's between me and the audience.
Okay.
Now, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I actually wrote that bio.
Yeah. Did I read it right? And so now you, now that I'm done interrupting you.
And this was in Florida?
It was, yeah. I'm living in South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And just terribly obsessed with comedy. And I developed a really unhealthy obsession with SCTV.
Which you still have.
No, I guess so. I mean, it's like it's all hardwired. It's part of the hardwiring now.
Yeah.
So I don't actually watch it all that often.
But don't you have like a VHS library of like all the SCTV episodes?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it took me many years to track them down, too. Lots of mail correspondence.
Yeah.
Just asking random strangers.
Pre-internet, pre-BitTorrenting media compiling.
Yeah.
That's the way it was.
When you actually had to hunt it down.
Yeah.
To go way back, actually, I was obsessed with Sesame Street. I would watch the test pattern for long periods of time because it was the first show that came on in my neighborhood and on Channel 2 in Boston.
Okay.
And I would really happily sit and watch the test pattern waiting for Sesame Street to come on. It was like a little game, like, what is it going to be, a really long time? And when that music kicked in, that was probably the happiest moment of my day. And And then by age eight, I was watching Monty Python, and my mission in life was to be able to stay up until 11 o'clock to watch Monty Python every night.
Okay.
And then SNL. And then when SCTV came along, something really in my brain just kind of clicked, and that became the thing. And I just became obsessed with that show. So when I found out there was a Second City Theater, I was amazed. Amazed. Like, what? There's this whole theater connected?
When did you find that? Like high school or junior high or something?
I think it was like late in high school. You know, I didn't really I just watched the show and that was that. And we didn't have access to a whole – it was South Florida. The whole place is just a sandbar.
Right.
And when I found out there was a Second City Theater, I thought that was pretty cool. And I saw their touring company about 85. And I copped to the fact that there was – like that improv was a thing and –
yeah.
And I never wanted to do it, though. I was just a fan. I didn't really aspire to do it at all.
Well, how did that happen then? How did you go from sort of fanboy with good taste in comedy to like someone who's doing it?
I started doing theater in college. I was going to my local community college in Lake Worth, Florida, Palm Beach Community College, Palm Beach Junior College at the time. And studying art. I was always taking art classes. I went to video school for a while. And then after that, I said, oh, screw it. I'll just go to community college and do more art. And
like illustration art?
Design art. Yeah, I was more into, I guess, fine art, you'd say. And then I took an intro to theater class, got really caught up in this professor. I really fell in love with this professor, Frank Leahy. And just through a strange set of circumstances, I got roped into being in this play. And that I really didn't want to be in, and I was miserable. But I really liked the people, and I got caught up in the community, and so I started doing theater, and I did it very badly.
What play was it?
It was a play called Holy Ghosts.
Oh.
And I was student director. I volunteered to be student director on the play.
Okay.
And then he has only two small lines in the play, but he has to speak in tongues. And it took place in a Pentecostal church. And this guy dropped out of the play at the last minute, so I was forced to take over his role because I was just right for it. And I was just god-awful. But I think my awfulness actually worked for that particular role because I was playing an awkward boy, and I was supremely awkward. and I continued doing theater. I think they just put me in these plays because they needed warm bodies. I was like spear carrier in some shows for a couple of years, and for about a year doing it very poorly. And then I got a part in a play called Red Noses, and I got my first big laughs on stage. That really changed everything. So I was still really into comedy, but doing theater was a whole separate discipline, and it was all about being truthful and being believable and all that. And I just kind of immersed in that.
What did you like about Frank Leahy? I've heard you mention him before.
Everything.
Oh.
He had really high standards. He was just he inspired everybody.
Is this the guy where I've heard you describe? Was he kind of like a tough guy teacher? Like, you got the courage? I can't remember. Wasn't there someone who like go to New York and?
He was like your dad. He was the archetypal dad. Like there was so much love coming from this guy, but he was really demanding at the same time. He had high expectations of everybody. You know, that was just implied. That was the subtext that was there. And he would come out and drink with us. You know, we all became very good friends. I stayed friends with him all through my adulthood, and very close friends. And then we were doing a play called The Mystery of Edwin Drood, mm-hmm. which had all these different combinations of endings. It was a book that was written by Charles. It was the book that Dickens died when he was in the middle of. So Rupert Holmes wrote a Broadway musical where the script ends in the early part of the show. And the audience has to decide. They get to vote on what characters are going to sing what songs and all this business.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first show that Billy Merritt was in at the college. And so we did a lot of improv because it was such a kind
Billy
of...
Billy Merritt, we've had on before.
Yeah.
Other big teacher, other member of the Swarm.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about meeting you in his interview with us.
Every improv group I've ever been in had Billy Merritt in it.
Yeah.
I think we've been in five or six.
Yeah.
So Billy came around and we were doing these improvisations. He was... unbelievable. He was off the hook. No one could touch this guy. Everything he said was hilarious. And I thought, oh, good, now I can start a group. I can start an improv group.
Huh.
And just because the fact that Billy existed I thought, well, okay, this guy can anchor a group. And so we cobbled together whoever was around, and we put together our little improv group.
Mm-hmm.
We did our shows at this place called the Arts Bar in downtown West Palm.
Oh, which was very
very desolate, very desolate. It was nothing open at that hour except the Arts Bar. They didn't have a liquor license, so they sold beer and Dixie cups for donations. And we got the Sunday at 11 p.m. slot. We went, the guy, everyone in town just like would not give us credit. The theater, like I was doing lights for the theater company in town. These actors would not give me the time of day. And we couldn't get respect from anybody. Hmm. And even the arts bar, they had like all this avant-garde jazz and all this really, a lot of bullshit kind of stuff that just wanted to be avant-garde. They had good stuff too, mostly music. And they graciously gave us that
Sunday at 11.
We were pleased as punch. We didn't really complain about it. We were just psyched to have gotten a slot.
What type and of show did you do there?
We stole Second City's show for our first our first show. We just because I had committed so many of Second City's like they're touring, you know, some of their touring scenes. Uh-huh. So our first show, we just stole Second City's. We improvised as best we could with no training. I just learned the forms. I just learned the forms from watching Second City. And I saw some PBS show called War Babies that had done, it was improv. And there was maybe one or two other little snatches of it that I caught here and there. But then we started writing our own material. Of course, after week two, we were writing our own stuff. Mm-hmm. And then my intention was to, that was the model I knew was Second City. So I thought, well, we'll develop a bunch of sketches. We'll put together a review. We'll run the review. And we'll do a lot of improvs in between the sketches. But the same exact audience came back week after week. We had a full house, but it was the precise same people came back week after week. So we couldn't do a review. We had to write new material. We were going to lose our audience from week to week. So we wrote a brand new sketch show every week for a couple of years.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So we'd do about 5-6 original sketches and then pepper improvs in between those.
Okay.
When do you get to New York from this?
I left early. They were still doing, it was the improv troupe with no name, and we weren't
satisfied. Hold on a second. Wasn't there a name called Comedy Squad?
We weren't satisfied with the improv troupe with no name. And we decided to change to the brilliant name of the Comedy Squad. It's clever. It's punny.
I love it. I love it. Wow. Part of something called Comedy Squad.
Now, David Blumenfeld was starting to do shows with
another
us.
Another swarm guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Billy really wanted Dave in the group. And I said, great, bring him to the writers. Bring him to a meeting. And writers' meetings were every single night. Billy, myself, and Greg Madera would sit in Greg's apartment, write every night, take a break, watch Star Trek, and then we'd write some more. Dave came by one night, didn't say two words.
Yeah.
And I was like, Billy, we can't have this guy in the group. He won't say anything. And but Dave did do bits with us, and I liked him a lot. And but then I moved, and they added Dave and a couple other people to the group, and Dave then just really shined. And I would come back to Florida, visit a couple times a year. And the most exciting part about that trip was actually was doing scenes with Dave. That was really
Dave,
really
the mad
connected.
Genius of the swarm, would stand up there and kind of do brilliant object work and look devilish. He was the original cannibal in Kilgore.
Yeah,
right. He was the original guy who ate your character
in the one half of Delaney and Dave later on.
Yep.
Yeah,
founding member of the swarm. Dave was one of those actors that the less he did on stage, the more the audience would pay attention to him.
Yeah.
And we're over on stage right, all sweating our balls off, trying to make something happen, and Dave's over on stage left doing almost nothing and drawing all of the focus.
Right.
Because everyone's wondering, what's this guy going to do next? One of the great nonverbal performers.
Yeah, he would stand up and just draw an imaginary bow, declare a falcon dead, and that would like take over the scene somehow. Something like that.
So, you know what? So, a friend of Billy's mom came to see our show. And she had done improvisation. We're like, it's someone who's done improv before. I mean, it's really, we're completely isolated down there. We had no exposure to anything. Mm-hmm. I'd read Impro, half of Impro, Keith Johnstone.
Yeah.
And that's about it. Maybe Spolin, that was it. That's all we had for resources. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't an oral tradition. It was like just whatever bits and pieces we could find, and we just put it together.
So when you talk about like how doing theater...
Let me just finish this.
Sorry.
A friend of Billy Merritt's mom came to see our show, and we were so psyched because she had actually taken a class in improvisation.
Uh-huh.
So this was someone that we really wanted to hear their opinion. And she told us, you guys are very funny. But it was clear that we were doing it wrong. She like basically told us our improv was piss poor. And it's true. Our sketches were good, and our improv was just organized grab ass, really. And she had studied at the National Improvisational Theater here in New York, and which was run by Tamara Wilcox Smith, who is a member of the committee. And Tamara sort of took Del Close's teachings and just got them boiled down. And that's what she taught. It was just like pure hardcore Del Close style improv. And so she sat down with us and went through her whole packet from the NIT. They have this packet you get. It's a 16—their first course is a 16-week course. And she went through it page by page. And
this is the friend who had taken a class with NIT, yes, talking to you guys in Florida.
Yeah, she sat us down. And when I heard what she was saying, it all just started making sense.
Huh.
And I was just out of there. So my plan was to go to Chicago, but my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, got accepted to the Neighborhood Playhouse. And so she was going to move to New York, and I had some health issues I had to take care of, so she moved ahead of me, and then I moved up in 91. Yeah, 91. Studied at the National Improv Theater. Went crazy. Everything Tamara Wilcox told me was like, it was like remembering something that I already knew. It was always Del Close said this and Del Close said that. And every time she quoted this Del Close character, it was just like the thing I'd been waiting to hear.
And the other guys who eventually would move to New York were still in Florida?
They're still doing Comedy Squad in Florida. And I called them and said, you all must come up here. We're going to start a group, and it's going to be the greatest group ever. And everybody moved up. We all lived in my apartment. We had this great sublet on 24th Street for $375 for a two-bedroom. Wow. So we all lived there. It was three blocks away from the NIT. We took our classes, and Tamara was like, you know, we don't really bring in groups, pre-existing groups, and train them and put them up. But we did take the classes as a group, and they did put us up. And we created Lost Footage, and we played Friday nights at 9 at the NIT.
You always end up with that slot.
So. Yeah, for a while. And then NIT kind of moved. They all moved to L.A. We stayed in New York.
Mm-hmm.
My healer, Dr. Ken Kobayashi, Master Ken Kobayashi, donated his dose. So
maybe you should explain what a healer is, since nobody knows except for you what that means.
Well,
right?
He practices Eastern Chinese medicine.
Yeah.
Okay. we were playing here. We had to play here and there. We were renting out places. We did a run. We would do runs at the Duplex and places like that, short runs.
I saw a show at National Improv Theater.
Oh, yeah?
Like in 93. Does that make sense? Yeah. Would that have been around? 92?
Yes. 93, yes.
Could have been 92. I graduated college in 92, and then some friend of mine was like, you would like this. And dragged me down to see it. And mm-hmm. It was like a Friday night show. It was like a piano player.
Mm-hmm.
Did like musical improv at the top the way like Frank Spitznagel would do at the top of CCL.
And they were very musical, yes.
Then there was a bunch of games. Almost like medium form. Not short form, but there were
Billy
like
tagged it medium form. Well, she was big on the Harold. Tamara's thing was like teaching the Harold. So we did the committee-style Harold. We did the 60s-style Harold.
Okay.
Which is very loose. It was structureless. You just went at it. You just did smart scenes, as many scenes as you could, and looked for connections. And really, we were big on looking for themes. What was the overall theme of this Harold? And how many different angles, how many different points of view could you find on one theme?
I want to just put a penny in or whatever, put a pin in this thought for later.
You could put a penny in a thought.
I don't know. I'm bad at metaphors.
If I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go on.
No, you can. One thing I like about you and the other Swarm guys, Billy and Dave, and even the two Andys, who I know had different training, was, I mean, right now most of our teachers studied at UCB either only or primarily, but Delaney and Billy bring in stuff from other schools of thought. You know, like you trained so much at this place, at NIT, and you also had acting training from before.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely influences, like, things you teach and the way you guys perform. Like, The Swarm, one thing that made you guys stand out was it was way more physical and theatrical beginnings, like a lot of scenic, I don't even have the vocabulary to say it right, but a lot more like Blumenfeld would come out and just be playing darts for a second, and then mm-hmm. Billy would pour a drink, as opposed to most groups. At the time of The Swarm, you'd see them say an idea to begin. They begin verbally.
Yeah.
And I think it's a lot because of the training you're talking about from NIT.
Well, I think that was very typical of improvisers around then. Anyone who was an improviser in circa 1990 were all theater people who found improv.
Right.
It was usually something that you did on the side, rarely primarily. It was primary for us, probably because we didn't have the means or the go-get-it-ness to be doing more proper theater.
Right.
We were all just like serious, hardcore comedy guys.
So things like finding a theme in the Harold, the Lucy Goosey Harold you were just talking about that
yeah.
Tamara pushed you guys to have.
That was pretty comfortable stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Lost Footage had a long run. It was myself, my wife Linda, Billy Merritt, Dave Blumenfeld, Greg Madera, and we picked up Bobby Kennedy, at the NIT, because everybody had a pianist. That was like standard. Any improv group always had a piano player.
Right.
And I asked Bobby, like, oh, hey, you could play piano. He's like, yeah. Like, well, come play for our show. Oh, actually, he forced himself on our show because we had these deadly pauses between our pieces. We would do all these different forms, and there'd be these long-ass pauses. He's like, can I play music between you guys? And I was like, please. And so I was thinking so much inside the box. And I kept asking him to, like, bring a piano, bring a piano. So he brought his little synthesizer. But he was really a guitarist, and he mostly played guitar.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so that was lost footage. We ran for, like, such a long time. And then Kobayashi donated his space to us. He literally gave me the keys to his dojo when he got his new dojo on 35th Street. We converted it into a theater on the weekends. We played Friday nights at 9. And we ran there for a couple of years. And then, you know, we'd been running for a while.
Now, what did you do for, like, a living? Like, how did you survive?
I was working for a jewelry master.
I was going to ask you about this, yeah.
Yeah, I was designing. I found out I could carve. I could sculpt minuetta. Like, I can sculpt, say, like, a lion that's the size of a dime with wow. wax. I found out I can do this.
Okay. How did you find that out?
Yeah, how does one get this a morning?
This was this insane drunkard jeweler who happened to be a genius, an absolute genius, mm-hmm. and he was doing high carat jewelry. He wouldn't touch anything under 18 carat was his big thing. And he loved lost footage. He used to, because Zigzag, we all hung out at the Zigzag Bar, which is now, it's on 23rd Street. It used to be Lucky Chang's. Now it's some mm-hmm. sports bar or something. And he came to our shows all the time, and he really liked Dave Blumenfeld. And his way of getting apprentices was just asking random people that he liked to come in and give it a try. And I was so envious that Dave got to go in and try it. So I showed Joel my sketchbook, and he was like, come on by. And I made my first day trying this, I made this little Cupid, and it sold. It sold. So I was an apprentice. I was now apprenticed.
Pretty cool.
Wow.
It was good because I could show up whenever I wanted. Mm-hmm. We could smoke whatever we wanted while working. It was great.
You've talked
great.
A lot about this guy in have classes I? That I've had with you. You've
really?
Talked about your experience
Why?
As a jeweler. I'm not
Why
sure.
Why would I bring that up?
You
I'm
talked
sure.
about the things that all fine art have in common.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Like how improv would overlap with jewelry making or any fine art.
He yeah. once looked at me. I made this error on a piece once. He looked at me. He goes, sensitivity of line. No, no, no. He says, continuation of line, sensitivity of form. As if he'd said it to me 100 times. And it was after that I gained an appreciation for people expecting things from you that you don't already know.
Yeah.
Frank Leahy did it. Joel Olson did it.
You do it.
This jewelry guy. I do it. The UCB did it. Yeah. Ian Roberts did it to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, be expected to know. You know, yeah. when you get hired to do stuff, like, you're just expected to know certain
yeah.
things. And
yeah.
there was terms I was expected to know. It's like, I've never heard that. I've never heard that word before. I can't wait to find out what that meant.
Yeah.
And then figure out what it meant in context.
Huh.
So, but the main reason I probably brought him up is because there was some really funny stories that went on there.
I think it was also very much what Will is talking about.
Those are the seven
that.
Pillars. Like, I remember one I had you
that
for
is, I've got that's the second thing on my list of things.
You were my level yeah. two let's teacher, Delaney. You were that. The second improv class I ever had at
yeah.
UCB. And it was a really fun class. Really good people were in there.
I think I brought up that stuff just because I was insecure as a teacher, you know. I'm teaching all these people who are my age or barely younger and often older.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't taught. I hadn't been teaching for very long. And I think I was just desperate to look
first
smart. The
first time I ever heard about the Seven Pillars of Art was Matt Donnelly told me that he was in a class with you where you went on this long speech
this
about it.
This was this class.
Oh, okay.
I was in class
and
with
And then Donnelly. I had asked you about it, and you said that you were, like, going through some kind of medical emergency.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. I can't believe it.
I literally had an aneurysm.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right. You were going to the yes. emergency room after class.
Yeah,
you were
yeah.
standing up and you were like, I'll be honest with you guys, I'm in a big haze right now. I'm very spacey, but I didn't yeah. want to, it was so last minute, I didn't want to miss
Why
the
didn't
class.
I just let the class, instead of going on this long speech, this dumb, pedantic
I
speech,
loved this.
Why didn't I just say,
Everybody,
you guys just go,
we
just
loved
do an
it,
Armando.
I mean, and also the class was fun
oh
and
God.
Funny, and I think you liked us.
Well,
I had
surgery
yeah.
on my wrist
yes.
because I got a kidney transplant and I was dialyzed for some time and I had this old fistula and the thing aneurated. Do you remember that? It was like the size.
Yeah,
of
I remember.
You showed it to
yeah.
us. You
like
showed us your arm and you had like this like
ball.
Videodrome David Cronenberg creature coming out of
your
wrist.
It was very Cronenberg. It was a bona fide aneurysm.
Yeah, it looked like American Werewolf in London on your
you know,
wrist.
You know what pleases me greatly? In the Swarm headshot, our group 8x10,
yeah.
I have my arms like on my I'm holding my arms on my side like this, and you can see the aneurysm. You can see it in the photograph.
Huh. Well, you had closely. Us get in a circle to do a pattern game ostensibly,
yeah.
But then we never did it because you were talking about the pattern game and loops and patterns, and then you said, well, you know, all fine art. Improv is a fine art. And then 20 minutes of, like, the pillars of fine art.
But right, let's move past this.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
It was an awful day for me.
This was late in the class. Yeah, I can't right. believe it.
Now that you've brought it up, let's say what the seven pillars are.
Yeah.
Emphasis, unity, balance, rhythm, harmony, grace, proportion.
Yeah, those are
great.
Really fascinating.
Thank God, I'm glad I've finally gotten this in a fucking recorded venue where I can listen to it.
Say it again, I love those words.
Do I really have to repeat it?
Yes.
Yeah, you do.
Emphasis, unity, balance, proportion, harmony, grace. No, I've gotten it wrong.
Well, we got it before, but say it again.
You better edit this out.
No. We're not editing anything.
No way.
Emphasis, unity, balance, proportion, harmony, rhythm, and grace.
Okay. You just said eight things.
Damn.
Well, now it's the
first one was right. Seven, then it was six, now there's eight.
Emphasis.
Oh, please.
Is it proportion one? No, we're going to do
this. Yeah, you said proportion. Emphasis, proportion.
Emphasis, unity, balance, proportion, harmony, rhythm, and grace.
Great.
We got it. Good.
It was interesting. It was a good talk. Brian Brebby, I know, would remember that. Mitch McGee was in there. Rob Latham.
Donnelly remembers it. Donnelly told me about it, and I was like, I've got it. And he told me that you went on a lengthy explanation of what each one meant. And I was like, I've got it.
You were clearly under the weather.
I was using the seven pillars just as a device for me to just go off on a long speech.
Let's jump ahead here. We'll come back to your history in a second. But one thing I liked about your classes, and that everybody likes about your classes, was it did make you treat improv as a grander thing.
Absolutely.
Like, I think that was the main temperamental switch of your classes. You know, if it was like a good group of people or a bad group of people, or one where you were energized and focused the way all teachers kind of ebb and flow from class to class, or maybe a little bit, you know, more aimless. The thing that unifies all of them is it makes students treat it like it's a serious thing. You love being told this thing that you like deserves to be treated better than even you already are doing. Like, it's inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you learn to treat it like a piece of art.
You were the missionary of treating improv like a real. You know, there's other teachers who are great for the exact opposite reason of demystifying it and making it simpler and more pragmatic. But your thing was, you walk out of it like it was a religion.
Well, yeah. It is a craft. It's a craft. And you're with art, everything's okay in art. If you just want to take poster paint in your mouth and spit it on a canvas, that's art. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's not a craft. Craft is craft. Craft needs fundamentals. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, it takes a craftsman to build a boat.
Right.
An artist can paint a boat.
Right.
And if you want to take paint and spit it on a canvas and call it a boat, it's a boat. But if you want to build a boat, you better be a craftsman.
Mm-hmm.
And if people want to do this on the path to professionalism, they should treat it as a craft.
And I think that's one of the reasons why so many people were afraid of having you as a teacher because...
You used that word fear earlier. And that's a thing no one wants to hear.
I'm sorry. Intimidating might be better because, like, you'd hear that speech, for example, and it would be genuinely fun. And, I mean, you're acting embarrassed about it, but it was a fun class. And to hear the words like emphasis, unity, grace, proportion would kind of like make us feel like excited. Like, oh, we're doing something that has room to be excellent in it.
I think that was the aim.
So that's good, right? But then it's like, okay, two up, your suggestion is lacquer. And it'd be like, and you all of a sudden want in the very next thing you say to achieve this kind of nebulous notion that you don't really know. I wouldn't know how to do that now.
Right.
And certainly in my second improv class ever, I don't have the presence of self or the comedic voice or the experience to know how to be this vision you've created. So it's intimidating. All of a sudden, it's like a lot to step off the back line. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily in a bad way, but you do walk out of the Delaney class like, I know it's this huge thing now, and I don't know how to get there. It's just important maybe that I'm now thinking of it that way, but that puts you in your head a little bit. There's no way around it.
It puts you in your head because you want to achieve, like you said.
Yeah.
Like, that's how I always felt. I was like, I would hear people talk about being intimidated by your classes, and I was intimidated in the couple of classes I had with you, but it was because it's like, I want this thing that is being presented.
Everyone's got Delaney stories who's gone through this school in a good way. But in a way, it's also made you a caricature a little bit sometimes. Like,
well, you went up an octave when you said in a good way. You said, in a good way.
Well, I saw your face. I felt bad. I can tell you a number of stories since I became a teacher, and I'd be friends with students, and I'd be hanging out like at McManus or something. And they'd be like, ugh, I'm starting this Delaney class. Oh, man, I don't know. He hates me. He hates everything I say, or I don't know, or I don't know what I'm doing. And I'd be like, yeah, that's Delaney class. You're going to love it. You're going to love it by the end.
All right.
It's kind of awesome. This to me, it's reassuring.
You know, when I got into theater, everyone took that shit so seriously.
Yeah.
Like, everything was, we were having fun. But, like, I feel like that's the highest form of fun, you know? What's the most fun for a football player? Like, to win a championship. And you got to take your stuff really seriously to get to that place, that degree of discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And the release, when you go out partying afterwards, I mean, you've been taking rehearsal that seriously for 4 or 5 hours, and then everyone goes out and parties afterwards, it's that much more fun.
I'm not arguing, and you don't have any reason to be embarrassed about this. I think it's fun. And an alumni, when they come back and want to take classes, it's like they want to take a Delaney class.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go back to your – we're in New York. Lost Footage is performing for a number of years. You're working for a jeweler.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and
NIT has moved to L.A. for the most part, so you guys are just kind of adrift.
And then I got another kidney, a really good one, from my buddy Beowulf, mm-hmm. Riggins.
You said another kidney as if we had mentioned kidneys before.
I brought it up. Because that's why I had that fistula, why I got a damned aneurysm.
Oh, you're right.
Aneurysm med.
So you got another kidney, a better one.
A really good one.
Kidney number 4.
And no, this is kidney number 2.
My bad.
And
well, you start with 2.
Oh, kidney number 4 total.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Second
new
second fresh one.
Yeah.
Replacement. 4 total are in there. And I heard this group came to town, Upright Citizens Brigade, and that they had all studied with Del Close. And
this name that you had learned to revere through Tamara.
Del Close?
Del Close.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yes. Oh, and since then I had looked up everything Del, and Truth in Comedy had come out also.
Yeah.
And I read Truth in Comedy, and you know, there wasn't anything that new. Everything that was in Black and White in Truth in Comedy, I had already heard from Tamara, and we were really trying to apply. But that structure, the Harold structure that they talk about in that book, was much more rigid than anything we had done. And we tried it, and it didn't work for us, you know, because we were unsupervised, you know. You really do need good directing and good coaching. And when we tried that structure to Harold from the book, it just didn't work, and we went back to doing our amorphous Harolds. But I remember when I recovered from my kidney transplant, the first show that I saw when I was well enough to go out into the world again was Bucket of Truth. And it was a damn good sketch show, but their long form at the end was really, really impressive. It was the most impressive long form I'd seen. And the chief reason for that was because they played stuff so real, like absolutely real, a little realer than real, flat-footed, very direct, very straightforward, where these guys were just communicating with each other the way they would on the street. And I hadn't seen that. And via that, they were finding incredibly sweet games.
And it was also funny. I mean, when I first saw the UCB do improv, what struck me was how unbelievably funny it was.
I'd seen so many funny people over the years. I mean, you see funny people on stage and on TV and on film your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they were so funny, of course, that was a big part of it. But the approach that they had to their scene work was, it had a quality to it of realness, through which they were finding their games that really appealed to me. And I said, we got to get these guys. We were desperate for direct. I had been directing Lost Footage all this time, and the group was tired of me.
Didn't Kobayashi tell you to fire yourself as a director?
He did. Yeah. Ken kept saying, like, hafu to talk. So finally I made him go out, like, what's this thing we need to talk about? He's like, oh, yeah, I have to tell you. I have to first fire self. Fire self. I was like, okay. I was cool with that. Like, yes, I do need to fire myself as the director of the group. And then he basically went down the line and said, fire everybody except Dave. And I was like, I can't do that. He could have just said, like, you and Dave should do a show together.
Right.
But he's going round and round. I was like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And Lost Footage, we all took a class together. We took level one that was taught the first couple weeks is taught by Ian. Ian and Besser split that class. And I told the Lost Footage guys, like, this is it. And some of the, you know, And half the group just wasn't into it anymore, and half of us were. And the half that were was me and Dave and Billy. And we put together a pickup group called Naked Apartment, which was a good – and Katie Roberts and Joanne Morrison were on that, who were future Swarmers. Okay. So there was five future Swarmers on that team. Mm. Yeah. It wasn't a great team. It was a short-term team. But Amy Poehler was our director. We each gave her $5 a head. We met every Sunday at Ken's place because I had the keys. Huh. And for like 6 months, we had Amy Poehler for $5 a head for 3 hours.
Yeah.
It was great.
Pretty cool.
And then we got Ian to direct Lost Footage. So I was taking classes with those guys, being directed. Amy was directing one group. I was doing Lost Footage and Naked Apartment at the same time. So we had Ian directing Lost Footage. We had Amy doing Naked Apartment. And I became UCB's light guy. So I was doing sets with them after
so
their
show. This is like
shows.
97 maybe? 96, 97?
Yeah, 96.
Were they doing shows at Solo Arts at this time?
Yes.
Okay. And but when you originally saw them do improv, just a minor detail, but I'm curious about, was that like at, do you remember where it was? Was it Baby Jupiter?
The Red Room.
The Red Room, okay, yeah, above KGB Bar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what they're doing, Bucket of Truth. Mm-hmm. And then I came on as the light guy for Big Dirty Hands. And this is a great sketch show. And most of that stuff ended up on their TV show. And so we were all taking classes.
And you loved
Arts.
It. You liked them, sure. And you liked the classes.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I love thinking about you as a student and doing tech and lights.
Yeah.
I mean, you basically worked
I only paid for one class ever. I paid for that first class with real money. Yeah. And then after that, I never. And I took their classes over and over for a couple of years.
Now, why? Because they thought you were good and they wanted you as part of the world?
No, I was their light guy.
Because you did tech.
Yeah.
See, I like
I
the
was
idea.
Technically, I think I was the first technical intern. Yeah. Like, I was the first guy to get free classes.
You traded classes for work. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you kept doing that, kept hanging around because you wanted to learn what they were.
Working your way into the UCB world by teching and doing lights.
Sure,
I love it, mm-hmm. Delaney.
Well, I was a light guy in Florida. I was a light guy for the.
That's right, for the actors who gave you the Sunday at 11 slot.
No, that was a different crazy guy. Okay. No, but this was the local professional theater, the Palm Beach Theater Club of the Palm Beaches. No, they were the ones who wouldn't give me the time of day.
That's right.
The
That's
actors
right.
wouldn't.
Right.
So I interrupted you. So you're doing lights. You took all these classes.
You have this pickup group, Naked Apartment.
Yeah.
That Amy's coaching.
That, right. Yeah. That,
so
that's
like the swarm starts around here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then we're all taking classes. We did. Maybe we might have done a Mortal Kombat. I think because Besser would use the classes to create shows. Uh-huh. Also, maybe that was later. Anyway, yeah, we're all doing it, and so many talented people were coming around. The two Andys, and I was doing stage shows with them. The two Andys were always doing these big fat stage shows, and they would write me into those shows.
That's how I first saw the Swarm. I saw Andy Daly at Chicago City Limits, thought he was hilarious. Uh-huh. That got me on the mailing list of the two Andy shows, and I saw Big Reunion Spectacular in episode one, which you were in.
The Gala Reunion Spectacular. Yes.
Yeah. And then I heard of the UCB, found Ed Snibel's website, and the Swarm was listed, and it had the two Andys in it. And Conroy, who had taught me at CCL.
Sean Conroy.
So I went to the Swarm shows because I was like, well, I've heard of these names, and I know they're funny.
That kind of circuitous sort of seeking out is how all of us found the UCB.
Yeah.
Through,
you
like,
just had to, like,
searching. Yeah. Yeah. Really, really poking around. And everybody had so much talent and a good amount of experience, too. So, yeah, so back then it was, Andy Secunda and Andy Daly. Of course, Billy and me and Dave were around, and Paul Scheer and Rob Hubel came around, Owen Burke.
Right. Riggle probably wasn't too long after that.
Yeah, no, Riggle came later once the theater opened. This was all still at Solo Arts.
Okay.
And so
Chad Carter was around that time.
Yeah, Ari and Chad. And I thought, well, gee, I was always looking for the perfect group, always. And Secunda and I were both very artistically ambitious at the time. Secunda was traditional ambitious. I was just artistically ambitious. I mean, I had already dedicated – I was already 30 by now, and I had dedicated my entire 20s just to doing improv. And that's it. There's no money to be money. I wasn't doing – of course, I was terribly sick for a while. Sure. I only had the energy – when my kidneys were failing, I only had the energy to really – perform about once or twice a week, which is what it was. And then after I got better, all of a sudden all these opportunities, artistic opportunities, presented themselves. And that's all I ever focused on in my entire career, mm-hmm. was what artistically did it for me. I'm still not doing that well. I mean, I've made a living, mm-hmm. which is good, which is all I ever asked for. But unfortunately, sometimes you get what you ask for. So there
you made
it
a living never having to do anything really shitty. You know, you never had those horrible jobs that most of us have had.
Wait, no, I had really shitty jobs.
Like what? Like making little dime-sized lions for a crazy jeweler?
No, that was later. When I was younger.
Before
I,
that, you had shitty
jobs. Oh, that doesn't count. Before 24 doesn't count.
Oh, before 24?
Yeah.
No, after 24, it was mostly carving jewelry. And
yeah, you get amnesty for pre-24 jobs.
Oh, okay, because I had some really sex. Terrible. They involved scrubbing and sweeping mainly. Yeah, lots of scrubbing. I was always scrubbing something.
I think we've all had scrubbing and sweeping.
Well, I got a job as a dishwasher when I was 13, and I kept that job for 4 years.
Sure. That's a great job when you're that age.
It was fun.
Yeah.
Where was it?
At a Jewish bakery / deli / catering outfit.
I was a dishwasher when I was 15. It's soothing.
We all played hardcore cribbage and backgammon after hours.
Oh, you were 70. You said you were 13. You were 70 years old when you did this.
No, everyone I hung out with at the time was over 30.
Yeah.
I swear to God, I spent my night just partying with these 30-year-olds.
Partying? Dudes. You said cribbage and backgammon.
Yeah. No, we partied at the same time.
Okay.
Of course, there were no women involved.
Right. There never is.
No.
In those environments.
So I think we're up to the birth of the swarm at this point in your bio.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it seems to me.
So you guys are all floating around.
There's so much talent around. Obviously, some groups, you know, people are going to fall into groups. And I thought, well, we better do this sooner than later. And Secunda and I were always having long, long conversations on the phone about, you know, about the work and this and that. And so we contrived to put together the ultimate team. Now, I had been putting together the ultimate team for about 6 years. Well, after once I got involved in the classes, there was so much more resources. You know, back when we were doing Lost Footage, it was completely isolated. I didn't know any other improvisers. I knew CCL, and I didn't like that style, so I wasn't interested in doing that. And I only saw them maybe once. There was another group called the Pollyannas. And there
I'm
was
super
the,
guessing, were the Bert Furshners around?
The Bert Furshners were around, but they were not an improv group. They were a sketch group.
Okay.
And I was friends with those guys. I hung out with those guys. And then there was a couple other groups, and really never the twain shall meet. You know, we all just did our own things and rented out our own little spaces or hustled our
own.
But
now you
spaces.
Have access to all these people in the UCB world.
Yeah. So, like, this is the first time I was was able to access a scene. And there was it was a very... infantile is not the word. It was in its infancy. That's
sure.
it. In its infancy. And yeah, so Andy and I were always compiling lists, and like Naked Apartment was supposed to be the great team. And Kate Walsh was signed up for that, and then she bailed on us because Kate Walsh was a really good improviser. Boy, oh yeah, she was on that group Burn Manhattan.
Oh,
she
yeah,
used to
okay.
wash those men off the stage. It was so refreshing to watch a woman completely upstage, not intentionally, comedically.
Yeah.
Just wash those guys out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so Andy and I kind of met with Amy after a lot of us kind of scheming for a while. We met with Amy and put together a roster, and then,
That's interesting to me because I had thought, I'm only realizing now I thought this, that I thought Amy put it together.
No. No, Andy and I had been talking, wanting to put a group together for a while. We're always arguing about who should be in it and who shouldn't be in it. And then one afternoon, I just talked to Amy and asked her if she would, help us put this group together.
I see.
We all met at her place, and we met for a while and talked about the group. And at the end of that meeting, we had that list of the original seven. And Amy really wanted to do an original form inspired by rap music.
Yeah.
And we were all very white. I think Sean maybe liked rap, but none of us knew rap. She made a mixtape for everybody in the group. We all listened to our rap mixtape. We wanted to do different
lots
levels.
Lots of Wu-Tang. I mean, there was tons of
there
Wu-Tang.
There was lots of Wu-Tang on it. We wanted to do lots of different levels and layers and try to integrate different layers that were occurring concurrently through the show.
Okay.
Even overlapping at the same time. And it ended up being interpreted in a very literal fashion.
And
this is
a form where at one point somebody would yell, break it down.
And
right?
we would do a big breakdown. And then,
oh, man.
And these breakdowns, we would all swarm in. And Amy would use that term, like, where you guys would like, when you do that thing, when you all swarm in, that's really good. So that's where the name of the group came from. We had a live DJ on stage. I remember, he was actually DJing.
It sounds terrible.
It was pretty bad. We only did that form for our first run, which was four shows at Solo Arts. Three of the shows weren't so good. One of them was great. We had one great show, and that was enough to come away with this one huge victory. It was pretty awesome. I remember Amy telling that DJ, like, give him a really high energy. They need a high energy intro. And the guy goes, ladies and gentlemen, the swarm. Ladies and gentlemen, the swarm. In this whisper. And so that became like a symbol of what was to come.
Billy talked about, when we had him on the podcast, he talked about Amy's influence, and he talked about the later influence of Armando.
He picked up. Yeah, Armando was our second director.
I mean, you had the best teachers. I mean, so yeah. you guys
we
were.
We had good directors.
Amy, Armando, and Ian. Mulaney. He said were your
For the swarm, but I just mean
swarm,
and then Ian for Naked Apartment. I mean, like, they were taught by them.
Just in general, your infancy in the New York
UCB
City
world. Yeah.
UCB world was, you were really touched by great teachers.
Yeah, we had the best directors. Yeah, we had Armando for quite a while, actually. I don't know how long Amy was directing us, but I think the show came up. I think the UCB got their TV show, or who knows what. And we had Armando, and then we just ran. Once the theater opened, that was incredible. It was so nice to have our own
The 22nd Street
clubhouse. Yeah.
But let me, as I want to do, take it back to myself.
Wait, hasn't it been an hour so far? I feel like it's
been.
Good God.
It's been 45 minutes.
Wow. We've barely been touched on.
Yeah, this really shouldn't have been me telling my whole personal history.
I don't know. I love that stuff. For me, I mean, let's. I won't bring myself into it. I was going to bring shows I remember from the solo arts, but we don't have to talk about it.
Can I talk about one swarm show that I wanted to bring up? Is the this is back when Secunda was writing for Conan. You might remember
the
show. It was
story.
A cage match.
Yeah, I know this.
Versus Pound, right?
Yeah, right.
So Secunda would always show up late for shows because he was writing for Conan.
He showed up late anyway.
Oh, okay.
He does that now.
Oh, he does? Okay.
Yeah.
But there was one show where you guys were doing your opening. You were doing a Harold. You were doing an opening. You'd gotten through most of the opening when Secunda burst through the curtain to huge applause from the audience and sort of just integrated himself into the opening. But then the opening sort of became about how, like,
we
Secunda
used it.
had stolen focus.
Yeah.
And then the first scene was you and I think Billy, and your initiation was, just because you're getting laughs doesn't mean you're working properly. And it became this...
nothing wins friends faster than the onstage note.
But it was... The show became this very meta show, and you sort of addressed it and played with it and had fun with it, but it was... not meta in the way that you see, you know, 98% of meta, which is like, we're out of ideas. You know, it's like you actually used the meta approach to create a good show.
Yeah, yeah, it worked the first time. Secunda did show up late on later occasions and did jump up on stage. And there were some attempts to kind of maybe approach that same thing, and they didn't work so well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's
got to
be fresh, man.
What did you think the approach was? Why do you think that it worked well in that instance?
Because it was fresh.
Okay.
The second time, I was like, hey, we've done this before.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the fun in that? I hate repeating myself. I feel like if I'm on the improv stage and it's not absolutely fresh, I don't want to be involved. Well, that didn't sound right. It's just not for me.
No,
it's true. Yeah.
If you want to do it again, write it down. You know, if you want to make it a sketch, make it a sketch. Mm-hmm. But no, if it's not something that's new for me, that just kind of sucks the fun out of it.
Uh huh. Yeah.
I've mentioned a lot of great swarm shows in the podcast before, but I'll mention a couple of them now anyway. We won't have time to go into any of them in great detail, but I remember at Solo Arts seeing the Harold in the Dark you guys did around Halloween. It was like, it was either Halloween or like the show before or after. And Connor, it was like, we're the Swarm. We have a special Halloween show. And the lights went out, and it was a Harold in the Dark.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was a lot of fun.
Super great. Standing ovation from the 40 people who were there. I remember the Narcoleptic Drill Sergeant show, Delaney, at the 22nd Street Theater, where the suggestion was Narcolepsy.
Narcolepsy.
No. The suggestion was Narcolepsy because you asked...
Catalepsy.
You're right. Catalepsy. You're right. Narcolepsy is not a word. Catalepsy.
Narcolepsy is a completely different affair. yeah, catalepsy.
But it's a word... Whatever the word was, it's similar to narcolepsy because you asked for a suggestion. Somebody in the back said it. I guess it was catalepsy. And then you said, oh, and what does that mean? And they're like, oh, it's like narcolepsy. And then you're like, okay, how is it different? And the guy's like, I don't know. It was
something like that.
Yeah, it was really funny beginning. I loved like sussing out the suggestion. But then you did the group game where you were the narcoleptic drill sergeant. Mm-hmm. The scenes were very indirectly inspired by narcolepsy to the point where we forgot the suggestion in the audience. And the second group game came out and you were the narcoleptic drill sergeant who just was a super angry, vicious drill sergeant who kept falling asleep and collapsing on the floor right. mid-scream.
Yeah, yeah.
But your the physicality of your fall, I was sitting next to Curtis Quinn watching the show and he was howling, laughing.
They made some good attempts to prop me up, too.
You fell over. Nice. I remember you fell in a way that your feet, your ankles were bending, but your feet didn't leave the floor in, like, the last possible second that you'd snap up and, like, hit the floor hard. It was super funny looking.
I loved taking falls. I avoid them now, but used to look for any opportunity to take a good fall.
It was, like, crazily broad and big and super funny. And just with a bellowing scream right in the face of Sean Conroy right before. Yeah, then they were all holding you up, and you're like a marionette loose and falling.
It went back and forth between them being, like, absolutely punished in this the abject misery, and then this guy, and then having to be really concerned about this man as a human being.
Yeah, is he going to be all right?
It was a nice – you know, that thing, though, about dancing around the suggestion was sort of an unspoken mission for that group. Of not hitting things directly on the head, you know? We like to take an indirect approach. There was one show we had where we got a suggestion. It was a very obvious kind of suggestion. And we did a really good job of addressing it in some very sideways manner through the whole show.
You're talking about the Tracers show where Dildo Factory was the suggestion? The scenes took place very obviously in a dildo factory, but nobody ever said the word dildo.
Now that you mentioned that, I remember
they
this.
They were miming dildos and people were making dildos, but the scenes weren't about dildos.
We worked the dildos into the fiber of the scene without ever addressing it. Yeah, no one
that
ever
was pretty
said
badass.
Dildo. Yeah,
Secunda almost said it and he covered his mouth. What did we do with all these? Whoop! And he covered his mouth.
There was this one show that we had this suggestion. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, it was yams, because we used to get yams all the time. Remember that when yams were a big suggestion? Yeah, everyone was getting yams for a long time.
Yeah,
long time.
Forgotten about that.
You know, food suggestions are very common, and I think it's because of the hierarchy of needs. I think it's because food is such a, as a mammal.
You know what? Most
mammal,
of my suggestions
such
are
an
foods.
Important, yeah, yeah.
Foods
yeah.
or textiles are two very common groups of suggestions.
Yeah.
Textiles?
Yeah,
really.
Cloth, corduroy, jeans.
Again, food and clothing, hierarchy of needs.
It could be.
I thought we did an expert job of using the suggestion without ever really hitting it. And on the drive home, my mom was at the show that night, and we're driving back, and mom just looks at me. She goes, "Where were the yams?"
Yeah, audiences want to see the suggestion.
Over 50. Anyone over 50 needs to hear the suggestion.
Anybody who's not an improviser, I think. My friends who are not in improv will come see shows.
They'll
be like,
"Oh,
that
other
group used the suggestion better."
I can't believe you're siding with my mother on this one. But we used the suggestion, Will Hines.
I don't know. I think your mom has better instincts.
We're parting ways.
It's over.
You had mentioned Blumenfeld's object work. And you also have great object work that
you
are known for.
Thank you.
How do you approach object work? How did you get good at it?
I don't know.
What? Come on.
What do you mean, what? Come on. I never took a mime class.
But it's
I like mimes. I like Marcel Marceau. I used to watch Shields and Yarnell mm-hmm. for their very short run before they got canceled in the 70s. I went out of my way and made sure to watch Shields and Yarnell. I'm the only person in comedy who likes mimes.
Yeah.
So it's by observation, you think, that you picked it up.
It might be by – but I mean, watching Shields and Yarnell when I was 8 or 10.
Gethard tells
probably.
The story of you having to play a guy wearing braces, like walking with braces,
yes.
and you propping yourself up onto the braces, and that it looked like you physically were leveraging your body higher.
I love that. I don't know. I think it's because I do like physical comedy a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the Three Stooges when I was a kid. All the Stooge stuff's been popping up lately. And I saw a thing. I hadn't seen the Stooges for years and years. And then I was watching this bio about the Three Stooges, and I looked at Mo Howard, and I was like, oh, my God, I've stolen those moves. Like, I can see how I've borrowed a lot from Mo. Three Stooges. I just like physical. There's certain things, you know how it is. You look at something, you're like, hey, I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh, okay, you need a panther out of wax? Like, I think I can do that. Even without a picture of a panther, for some reason, I can carve a panther. It helps to have a picture, though.
Sure.
So, you know, I just love it. It's not something I ever practiced or trained. I just, I don't know. I think because I want to do it, I can do it.
Let's say we have 10 minutes left. What do we need to hit?
We spent all this time just talking about my stupid life story?
Death. You're the guest.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well,
we can I think that stuff's really interesting.
Yeah, we didn't mention the Stepfathers, though. So, wait, I got to Swarm.
Okay, yeah.
So I got to Swarm. We ran for a long time. Right. And then we closed. And then it sort of transmogrified.
Everybody left for L.A.
Everyone left. Billy and I were the only ones left.
Right.
So we formed the Stepfathers. Mm-hmm. Gee, the original Stepfathers were...
Bobby
Moynihan.
Chris Gethard. Peter Gwynn.
Yes.
You and Billy.
And Brian Husky.
That's right.
And there's been many, many changes. And now, happily... Will Hines.
Will Hines is
a member of the Stepfathers.
Thank God, finally.
Yeah.
And we play every Friday night at 9 o'clock. So Swarm played Fridays, too.
At 10.
Was it 10?
Originally, yes. And then 9:30.
It was at 10, yeah, originally.
I've done a Harold every Friday night since 1992.
You'll get there. let's see.
You mentioned people moving to L.A. So many people, so many of your friends and performers have moved to L.A. What keeps you in New York?
Hey, New York is the new L.A. I don't know. I love it here. Yeah. I'm completely entrenched here. I have a wife who has a career, mm-hmm. and I have a son who has a career, mm-hmm. and I have a bit of a career. And I've got all these medical entanglements, and I just can't visualize. I can't see. There was a point where I was really thinking about it way back, mm-hmm. and... Linda wasn't so warm to that idea, and I love New York. I've had a love affair with New York City my whole life, and I don't have a love affair with California at all, so I guess I'm just following my heart on this one. Mm-hmm.
Believe me, I'm happy that you are that you've stayed in New York.
I am too. Well, I think people are starting to come back.
You think so?
A couple L.A. people are starting to come back, and I hear rumblings of people who've been in L.A. for a while wanting to come back.
Hmm.
Yeah, I do.
It could happen.
I think New York is the new LA.
I'm putting it right here first, yep. And probably only. How about stuff you like to teach in classes? What are things that you tend to like to give notes on, or things that you find yourself working on either because you think they need it, or and that combined with that you like to work on it?
Well, these days it changes year to year, in general, and especially, I think these days, number one is people doing it together. That's where it's at, together. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So as opposed to somebody initiating an evolved idea.
No, I have no problem with that. I have no problem with that. As long as whoever initiates that idea includes the other person, and as that moves forward, and as that idea ferments and changes, because change is such a necessity. So no matter, even if you have the clearest, most brilliant premise that's absolutely clear and crystalline, it's going to change as that scene moves forward. It must. Mm-hmm. And so that demands involvement from the others. And so, whether it's the most organic scene or one that is a very punchy premise-based scene, seeing the players of the ensemble really doing it together and finding it together and moving it forward together. Is really
but how do you even measure that? Is it just like seeing if they're reacting to each other and being affected by each other?
Sure.
What happens in your classes these days? I haven't had one since 2000. What are they like?
We do a lot of scenes, a lot of
four. I had a class with you a few years ago. I was
yeah.
A 401 or a 501.
Oh, that feels like such a long time ago.
Right?
I like to let them really get up ahead of steam. I love, I like when, say they're doing a long form and they feel like it's over. Either enough time has passed or they've gotten to their third beats. And then have them keep going for a while after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's that moment where you feel like, I feel like this scene should be done. And a lot of times they really haven't begun to truly improvise. What they have is they've exhausted all the preconceived notions that they had about the scene. So everything they already knew or thought or felt about the scene kind of got done. Mm-hmm. And that's when it gets really interesting, when they get pushed beyond that point.
When that freshness starts.
Yeah.
That you're talking about.
Yeah. That's when it gets exciting. And that's where people start to really surprise themselves. There's that element of surprise. The unknown, I think, is so much more valuable than the known. Because there's all these factors that we do know. And then we need to push beyond that. And sometimes we get, I think long form, it's changed so much, especially in the past five years or so, where it's getting to be very much, very content driven and very much, like sketch, almost like we're trying to simulate sketch comedy. I think sketch and improv have always been cousins and always come across from an audience perspective. They're very similar and they seem very similar. But approach-wise, The way I approach a sketch, the way I approach an improv show could not be more different. Now, the way I perceive, the way I enjoy a sketch show from the audience, the way I enjoy an improv show are very much alike. Mm-hmm. But the point of attack is almost completely different. But I feel like the point of attack in long form is becoming very much like we're trying to write a sketch on our feet.
I think that's true, and I don't know if I think that's bad. I think there's an aspect of that that makes you decisive and responsible to making the scene funny. I mean, a lot of improv I've seen over the years that I haven't liked has been aimless and sort of group huggy and like everything will be okay, but we're not going to make any decisions. I know that's not what you're saying, but I think like the urge to write a sketch on your feet, part of that I like is like have a point, make a decision, get there. You are responsible for making the scene about something because people are watching you.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm not saying this to argue you.
You know what comes into my head time and time again? I watch a lot of basketball. As I'm watching basketball, I can't help but think, of course, everything if you're a hardcore improviser, all the things when you look at different crafts and different, if the movies or if you're at a play, if you're at a museum, if you're watching sports, you see relevant things to improv.
Yeah.
And it's about the extra pass. The extra pass is really where it's at, waiting for that sweet shot. We can all take the jumpers. So I feel like we're all just taking a lot of jump shots, like have offense. It's all offense now. And that extra pass is where it's at for that discovery. So if you got a good premise, we want to take that premise somewhere. So we're going to do it together and make that discovery together. Like you brought up this narcoleptic drill sergeant scene.
Yes.
I thought that was a good idea. The audience liked it. It was the rest of the ensemble that carried it.
Yeah.
They made – so I came up with the idea and executed the idea in a clear way so that the players and the audience got it. Right. Then it was total. Then I didn't do anything creative from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
I played an archetypal drill sergeant. Zero creativity was required from me. All the creativity was passed on to that group. And they brought that scene forward and made discovery after discovery together, spontaneously. So when I came awake and went back to the archetypal drill sergeant, I was just being a drill sergeant. I passed out. They made a new discovery each time.
So what you're talking about is not just, here's the premise I'm presenting. Oh, okay, well, what's all the things that could happen off of this premise? It's, I'm presenting this premise. Okay, now let's discover what might happen in this world of, am I saying that properly?
Yeah, I think so.
Challenge, Delaney.
Oh.
So what?
Wait, we're arm wrestling.
Yes, we are. We're doing that. Well, I think, like, isn't
that was vocal object work.
Yes, that's right. And even there I bailed. Because all object work I collapse on.
I accept your challenge.
I can only speak in terms of arguing. I don't mean I agree with your points, but I'm curious, like,
I come from an Irish family with
Then.
Kids.
Good, yeah. Okay. Well, I come from a New England repressed family, so this is way out of my comfort zone to confront anything directly. So
surrounded by Protestants.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you goddamn Catholics, you got to come over. So how about if you're the extra pass, I feel like brought to too much of an extreme, it leads to aimlessness. You and I have done scenes, I think, where we've enjoyed them and they've been they've just been sort of fun conversations that you wouldn't want to have as a sketch. I'm not saying that's bad.
I despise aimlessness. But you know what? I'll take okay, go on.
No, go ahead.
No, you got to get to your challenge.
No, I just had to do a double take.
Yeah, okay.
Now, what do you mean you despise aimlessness?
I don't like aimlessness.
Okay, so what? Let me put this in a more helpful way. How do you avoid aimlessness? How do you not over extra pass? The great thing about the swarm.
You know how. Yeah. Be talented. That's how.
Yeah.
That is an answer to a lot of, you know, improv and a lot of craft issues is like, well, at a certain point, you just have to be talented enough to know how to avoid certain
to have instincts
and
to kind of know when it's time to pounce and when it's time to
absolutely.
And a lot of that comes from an ensemble as well. You need to have
practice.
If you two guys are having a scene that is maybe going into aimlessness, you need the ensemble sometimes
to
push you.
Being amused by each other helps. The good groups seem to be genuinely interested in what the other person's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they very easily get lost in, I wonder what they'll say. Like, and I think good improv, you know, moments on stage of any group, it'll be like they say something and you want to know. And you are sort of surprised in a good way.
I think, you know what, well, I said talent. It's really playing at the top of your intelligence. I mean, you know, and I think this comes right out of maybe Truth in Comedy of when you're hanging out with your friends, you know, that thing that happens of you guys really exchanging ideas. You're really talking about things that are relevant, things that are current, things that are present, and that are either important to you or are dynamic in your life. And you're talking about these things and putting them out there, and you're all funny people, and people are going to have takes on this. So you talk about and explore all this real shit that's happening in the corporal world, and everybody's certainly playing at the top of their intelligence because you're all smart people, and it's real life. So you're really super smart. If you maintain that smart, like that first show I saw from the UCB, they're playing so smart that there's almost a dullness to it at first, a seeming dullness. But when something's executed well, you know, if somebody's playing their art well, that's really entertaining. That holds the audience's attention. So if you're playing adult people who are relating to each other in a believable fashion, and you are talking about things that are either relevant, current, either important to you, the world at large, or at least to those characters in that moment, you have to trust that since we're funny people, if we lay out enough truths, we're going to extract something funny from it. Much sooner than later, much sooner. It's when we're trying to be funny or trying to entertain. That's what gets in the way. And you ask what I do in my classes. The first couple of three classes are usually spent trying to get people to act as on stage, in their scenes, act as smart as they are in real life.
It's hard to do. I think it takes practice because you're self-conscious about being – it's not as easy as it might sound.
Well, we have the tool of playing other characters than us. I mean, we play our own. You know, actually, improv gives you more freedom to play. You'll play more variety of characters in long form than you will in any other form of acting. Plays, movies, TV. Usually, you play pretty close to whatever
you're naturally falling as.
Yeah. So it's about point of view. You know. So then, if you pick characters and you discover different points of view that are a little off of your own or interesting points of view to discover. There's so much there, so much to work with. It's when people fall into chit-chat, that kind of, they often misinterpret playing at the top of your intelligence. Playing it real is to playing fact versus playing truth. Because what's more dull than facts?
Right, you want, still important moments and big
and
choices.
Reacting to
starting
things.
With fact is nice, but then you take the truths that live inside those facts, and that's where you can really, really explore and take off.
Mick Napier once wrote a fun essay called The Perfect Actor, and it was after some class he had that was frustrating where what he wanted actors that he was directing to be like.
Yeah.
Something like, don't be tired. It's okay if you're bad, but be doing stuff.
Yeah.
Something like that. Like, don't.
What's worse than a tired actor? Or an actor with a cold.
Like, I think Everybody Sit Together was one of his. Like, don't spread yourself around the room where you're separate. Be together when you're. Yeah. I don't know. He had things.
No, if you are tired or if you have a cold, that's fine. But if you're being the actor who's tired or being the actor who has a cold, it's just annoying.
Right.
Yeah, just go away.
So, do you have any? What do you like to see for the perfect? What's the perfect student? If you're a teacher, what do you for the perfect class? What do you hope you're going to see?
I really hope that I'm going to see people who commit 100%
and take talent out of it. Like, just I'm talking about attitude and things that people can do regardless of where your talent.
I'm a little hippy dippy. I think anybody can be a good improviser.
Uh-huh.
If you really show up, really commit, always give it the college try.
And what does commit mean?
Really, commitment means being in the moment, being in the character. Being in the character 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody knows what that means if you've had some training. But I think a lot of our students probably don't know what that means to be in the moment.
Yeah, a lot of people
or have never experienced what that is to be in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It just means being true to that character. Who's not you? You're playing an imaginary character. You're
right.
Playing a fictional
so
person.
So commit 100%.
Yeah.
It's the best that comes to mind.
If you do that and if you commit to your fundamentals, all your fundamentals, chances are you'll be a good improviser. To be great, you have to have talent. And you got to have a good sense of humor. You got to have a keen sense of humor.
I feel like you also like students who make big choices and surprise you. I feel like the students that you have enjoyed the most over the years are these people who make, they're fun. They're not even necessarily the best comedians and actors necessarily.
Not to parse words, but I have a problem with big. I've never been a fan of big.
That's I'm like saying words so you can parse
performances.
With
them.
Oh, that's right. No, I'm not a fan of broad.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends. You know, everything depends. I'm okay
that's
with some
fine.
Broad team.
How would you
but
express
I think,
what I'm trying to
I
say?
I think big is a poor substitute for specificity.
Okay. So specific choices.
Clear, specific, and things that are relevant to the scene and that are really, truly spontaneous. Really spontaneous. I want people to have the stones to truly be, because you know, you see players do the same kinds of scenes again and again and again, and that's
pretty
dull
stuff. Do
you
think that spontaneity comes from complete commitment? Do you think if you are committed 100% living in a character, then you're going to forget those like kind of bag of tricks moves or those like basic kind of moves in favor of reacting the way that character would?
I think I think excellent long form demands commitment. So I do think there's a relationship between those things. I think there's certain things that have to be in place to be for it to be great. And I think commitment is one of those things that just doesn't go that needs to be there. You can be funny. I mean, without really committing to character or being in character. Mm-hmm. I mean, all those things. People can be incredibly funny, but it's probably not going to be great ensemble. And seeing once things achieve ensemble, more entertaining.
I agree
and funnier.
With you, but as a teacher, how do you promote ensemble? Like, it's hard. It's
process. Process, process, process. My mantra is process over product. We used to talk about that a lot. Everyone used to say that back in the day. Owen Burke loved to say process, process.
Like, did he really?
Oh, yeah, all the time. It's not about product. It's about process.
I know he likes to say do it up.
Yeah, he likes to say do it up, too. And it is about process. It's about process. That's why I become such a bad writer, because I don't do it anymore. Mm. So when all of a sudden I have to write
a
sketch, it comes out pretty weak because I don't have my process.
What's process over product for ensemble work? Like in a class, like let's say you got a class and they're just not working together.
They got to do it true. They got to be true. At that point, I'll usually do like Park Bench of Truth or something like that, mm-hmm. which is a mm-hmm. huge eye opener for some people.
Yeah,
even more than it should be.
What like, is Park Bench of Truth?
That's how do you run it? It's in the curriculum, but I'm curious how you specifically do it. Don Finelli took your class and told me how you ran it, and I thought it was interesting. And I want you to say how you like to. Manage, how do you run Park Bench of Truth?
I have two chairs, and two people sit in those chairs.
Like, tell me and John how to do it as if we're students.
Okay, really?
Yep.
Okay, you two, we're going to give you a subject. You're going to have an honest conversation about that. Don't ask too many questions. Try not to do anecdotes about the thing. I want you to really talk about the thing. Like, so if it's Apple, you have an opinion of Apples. And no, I'll be darned, once people start that conversation, they skip immediately. They don't talk about apples. Someone might say, oh, I like apples. And all of a sudden, they're talking about Thanksgiving. No one says, apples make me think of Thanksgiving. They just start talking and skipping from one subject to another to another.
How long will you have that conversation go?
No more than 90 seconds.
Okay.
I tell them 60, but I usually let them go about 90 seconds. Mm-hmm. That's usually a hard cutoff point.
Okay.
And then there's an important factor where someone slides down.
Like a LaRon. So I'd
like
move out, John would slide over, and
he
somebody would join
John. Over and
yeah,
takes your
that's
spot
what John,
in the
chair.
I don't know why, but I feel like it's essential.
I started doing it that way, and it works great.
Someone
it's a good lesson
down.
In how to use a suggestion, how to be inspired by a suggestion in an elegant way,
yeah.
and how to speak in an interest. Everybody becomes fascinated with those conversations.
They're the most entertaining.
Yeah.
We're on the edge of our seats listening
yeah.
to these conversations.
They're super compelling.
And you find out, if you do it late in the class, if it's like week 5 or something, all of a sudden you find out these revelations about
yeah.
people.
It's amazing.
It's, like,
it's
well,
a great
why
exercise.
Why didn't you expose yourself that
yeah,
much?
We do that. That's in the curriculum in level 4. We do that week 4.
It's great.
Four.
I find those kinds of exercises are extraordinarily helpful because people don't think to tell the truths about themselves. They don't think to use their own human
It makes you appreciate the power of real conversations.
Yeah, it's that thing we're talking about
yeah.
before. Like you're hanging out with your friends and they're not trying to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
They're not supposed to be funny. They're not
but
in
they're
the
interesting
scene. They're just
and smart
being themselves.
And they're reactive.
And when they tell their real opinions about things, all of a sudden
yeah.
their soul starts showing.
Right. I remember Matt DeCoster telling me how much he hated parades and all the reasons why. It was really interesting.
Oh,
he also argued that
parades.
July was
it.
The most boring month of the year.
It's great.
Great opinions about that.
So then when you're in an improv scene, you have to be the guy, have the stones to just say things like that. Like, I will be the guy who just despises parades.
Mm-hmm.
Or for some reason, you just say, like, I think Veterans Day is the best holiday. And if you make these simple declarative statements, all of a sudden then all these other things start to fall in line.
Okay, pattern game. Talk about how you like to teach the pattern game. I know you hate the way we do it.
I like no thinking in the pattern game. Oh, and
you do it different than anybody else teaches it, which is fine.
That's how I learned it from Ian Roberts.
All right.
You know, Besser had a certain approach in the pattern game. Amy had her approach. Everyone had their approach.
What's yours?
Ian's is the one that spoke to me.
Okay, which is?
No thinking.
Which means?
Mm,
like specific.
Staccato.
Okay, John and I are students. Tell us how
yeah.
to do the pattern game.
Oh God, it's an effort. It's a long. It takes. These are long explanations. I don't want to teach class here.
I know, but I think it's interesting.
For Panic Game, I wanted to do it as a group. I want ideas to come out of the group mind.
Okay.
I had a class recently, and they're all coming up with these really clever long lines in their pattern games. And someone would go off on a little tear, and someone would do like a long line where they had to get a point across. And then the next time I asked them to have much shorter, just one word at a time. These really compelling ideas started to come out because they weren't thinking. I made them go so fast that they weren't able to respond to the last thing that they heard. They're responding to the collective.
The accumulative kind of where they're at.
Yes.
Okay.
And they were just engaging one word at a time, and much more interesting, much more funny and compelling ideas were coming out of that than the ones that they were putting out precognitively.
So now, and you also don't like returning to the suggestion. You find that inorganic.
No, I love it. I love it.
What? Really?
I love it. That's best case scenario.
Oh.
If you can come back to the suggestion and call that back, weave that back into bring it back and hit that pattern of the suggestion.
Okay,
that's a best case scenario. Mm-hmm.
So you like,
but it's not only case scenario.
Okay,
so they tend to. So I feel like students are.
We
too
teach
much,
them to robotically go back to it.
That's fine on the first day in level one.
By the way, I don't mind that you disagree with this. I'm saying this because I feel bad for the students who have had it hammered in their heads by at least two levels of teachers to do it a certain way. I actually don't feel bad. I love that they get exposed to a new way to do it.
But when you learn a craft, it changes as you go.
Everything is fine. It's just that I'm sure that's a shock of cold water to suddenly be told that.
That you shouldn't kindergarten-like repeat the suggestion. Repeat the suggestion back together and make it so clear to the audience that we all planned this beforehand. Who likes that for in the middle of middle of a pattern game for everyone to all of a sudden go X-ray machine together? Oh, doesn't that make your skin crawl when you hear that?
No, it doesn't. But
and it's just clear, like, this isn't improvised. You planned that. You guys all planned that.
I don't think that's the effect.
And people are spending their creative energy trying to come back to X-ray machine instead of just creating together. Because if they create together without thinking, without strategizing. See, I think strategy sucks.
Uh-huh.
In long form. Mm-hmm. I just think it sucks. And when it's this thing where it's your mission to all come back and say the suggestion together three times and then end on the third time, that kid who's sitting there spending his creative energy trying to get back to saying X-ray when these people should be really creating together and moving forward into the unknown, not strategizing how to get back to the known. That's where it's at for me. This is true. False. There's active, passive. There's the known and the unknown. And the unknown is infinitely more interesting than the known. And the known, there's those improvisers who can step out and be show-stoppingly funny.
Yeah.
And they're going to be great solo performers for their careers. But long form is a craft, and it's about doing it together. And the more those imaginations can get on the same page and get closer to group mind, that's where you get to the real lyricism of the work and not individual excellence.
So.
And not precognitive.
I love it.
Material.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I love everything you're saying. And but what'll happen is you're in. I don't know why I'm saying this.
Pragmatical son of a bitch.
Yeah, I know. I know.
What?
I love it. I think that people. If you haven't taken a Delaney class, you should take a Delaney class. You should do it. If you're in New York, you're missing out if you haven't done it.
So my class is just this weird lark.
No.
That people, this walking on coals that people should go through for the novelty and then go back to doing what everybody does.
Not at all.
All right.
I think it's a needed ingredient that's in short supply, frankly.
Now, see, when you say needed ingredient, that's like getting inoculized for something.
I think it's a neutered and sexless necessary energy. I don't know.
I think the way I've started to think about or approach the pattern game is being able to have a whole group like create a develop a premise and kind of be able to come out of the pattern game with at least between three and five solid premises to initiate from.
I agree. I prefer to emphasize themes.
Themes?
Because it's a premise. Okay. It's like, here's this. People's imaginations work in such different ways, because the premise implies that this is funny. And we all see scenes and themes as being funny for different reasons. Now, after a pattern game, when we do a postmortem on a pattern game, we always agree on what the themes were. We don't always agree on what was funny. And when someone does a hilarious scene, we all have different, often have different notions of why that scene was funny.
Let's do this.
But the class is always in 99% agreement as to what the unusual thing was. So I feel like if they can come away all on the same page as to what the themes were in that pattern game, then they're on the same page. Mm-hmm. But if we call it a premise, I feel like then there's an implication there that it's funny, and people's senses of humor are wildly different. But what people perceive as being unusual is almost always something that we can agree about that's quantifiable. What's funny is not quantifiable.
I think the difference between the way that I have been approaching it lately and the way you approach it is the difference between, like, just free your mind, don't think about it, and tap into that kind of creativity that will tap into your instinctive creativity instead of, like, okay, think about what is funny about this theme, or think about, like, what you can contribute to or add to this.
Well, the dirty little secret is, of course we're all thinking about what's funny about this. Mm-hmm. Of course we want premises. Like, yeah, that all goes without saying. Of course we want to nail our games. Would I like to be able to come out in, like, almost every scene with a sweet, crystallized guy? Of course. Mm-hmm. But in the real world, how often do we have that? Mm-hmm. So we got to be prepared, mm-hmm. man.
Well,
I just want to channel. I want to channel Del Close is what I really want.
You you had a workshop with him, right?
I did. I worked with Del. Yeah, one time.
That's how was that? Cool.
It was great. It was great.
I mean, it must have been such a preloaded experience, as you know, you're walking in to see this guy that you've already invested and attached all these ideas to.
Yeah, we have.
There's no way that one workshop can live up to that, you know? It's like the final episode of a 10-year TV series can never encompass everything you loved about that TV series.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, when you see, like, if you see that band, if you see the Rolling Stones, like, hey, this is great. I guess I saw the Rolling Stones.
Yeah,
maybe
that wasn't
their best day or whatever, mm-hmm. but hey, man, these are these cats that I love. And it so happened that I was kind of at the end of my student phase.
Yeah.
You know, I'm well into my 30s. I've been training for a long time.
Yeah.
I started getting professional work. You know, I was starting to be a working actor. I was transitioning from just being an improviser to being... Hello?
Sorry.
That's okay. I was transitioning from being an improviser to being a professional, and I was just starting to teach as well. So, and I kind of stopped taking classes. I think I had started up maybe as a teacher. I can't quite remember. I think I was on the cusp.
Yeah.
I think I was just about to be hired as a teacher. So that last class that I took was that workshop with Del. And he talked about the Harold quite a bit. He talked about openings. And he really, really talked about the Harold. I was like, great, I got it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
And that was nice, the timing in which it happened. We happened to be in L.A. doing one of the two Andes shows. Uh-huh. And Del was doing a free workshop for Improv Olympic L.A. students. And we asked Sharna if we could come by. She said, of course. She was very gracious. And so Secunda and I took that workshop together. And we did a scene together. We had a home run. We did this great scene. Well, Del was doing this technique at the time where he was doing monologues that were transitioning into scenes. So Secunda did a monologue, and then I did a monologue. And at one point in your monologue, because you're doing it, you know, no fourth wall, you're just telling the audience this story, and at one point in the monologue, you turn and you address your scene partner, and you complete your monologue talking to him or her.
Yeah.
And I did so, and we had this really great Delaney Secunda scene. So it was great, and that was fun. But hearing the lecture, hearing that lecture in person really meant – I actually have the tape. I still have the tape. And that was when people taped lectures.
Still happens. Ben Rogers taped a Peter Gwynn workshop we did where he went all over openings and cool stuff. That was fun.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a real treat. And Del died not long after that.
Hmm.
Not long after at all.
Yeah.
I actually heard that Del had died from Andrew Alexander when we were at the Aspen Comedy Festival, just walking into the SCTV reunion/symposium. And Horatio and I bumped into Andrew Alexander. He's like, oh, you know, Del Close passed away.
Oh, my God.
Andrew Alexander was the guy who produced all the SCTV shows.
Wow. Mm.
It's like a little crazy full circle-y stuff.
Yeah. We might have two podcasts here.
I think we got one.
All right.
My God, how long have we... I'm long-winded.
No, this all right.
We love it. We've been meaning to have you on for so long, actually, that we've just built up all the stuff.
Well, Frusciante said I could do the Christmas show. I really wanted to do a Christmas show.
We didn't get our...
New Year's shows are cold... They're chilly. They're impersonal.
This is a post New Year's show. This isn't really
Christmas
new,
shows
new
are,
show.
Are, but this is the first show of the new year.
Sure. Yeah.
And a new decade.
Yeah.
But Christmas shows were all warm. We'd be drinking a hot toddies or something.
Yeah, sure.
And we would just be having fun we and not 45 it. Minutes of someone's like.
No, we'd still
banal,
do that. We'd
no, that would still happen.
Yeah, yeah, it
that
would be a lengthy history of you with hot toddies.
There'd be more fellowship. Good fellowship between
us. No, that wouldn't
us.
Happen. John and I are emotional.
We're bots.
Yeah. Yeah, guess what? There's something called Christmas spirit.
We have
don't
none of
believe
it.
In it.
There's also Christmas. Hey, I've been witness to and party to firsthand Christmas miracles.
Do not believe in them.
Really? Name.
That's like, why you don't experience them, Will. You got to believe. Just believe.
Well, I mean, I think we had a lot of fellowship here. I think this is.
Yeah,
been,
I felt all right.
The love is always there. It's underneath.
Sure.
It's underneath.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you are, I consider you to be one of the most influential and inspirational
definitely.
People in my improv career.
In the UCB John. New York scene, yeah, it's definitely
oh, yeah.
True.
I mean, I took several classes with you because I looked forward to it.
I think it's just because I'm old.
No, it's because you're wise. No.
Oh, well,
it's because you're great at what you do.
But being old is part of it. Yeah, it's because you're old too.
The second class
been around
that I
a
took
lot.
When
yes.
I came back, the first class that I took was Mulaney, and then you were the second class I took because I was like, if I'm going to be good again, I need these two guys.
Let's do a bullet list of cool things Delaney's done.
Okay.
You did. You were a long time, like kind of frequent bit player on Conan, where you got to do a lot of super fun things. I feel like every night I would turn on Conan O'Brien
yeah.
in the early 2000s, and Delaney would be there.
Mm-hmm. I had. Close to 200 contracts on the Conan show.
Yeah.
Wow.
And a lot of really good stuff, too. I mean, a lot of meaty stuff.
Yeah, I'm putting a new reel together, and I was looking at some old Conan. I haven't watched these bits in years and years, and I looked at some of those old Conan bits last night.
Uh-huh.
There was one that was long. It was long, long, and I didn't remember it at all. If someone had asked me if I had done that bit, I would have said no.
Now that I remember it, you were in one of my favorite ever Conan bits. It was a later bit, but I still laugh at it, which was... Star Wars characters that were cut.
Yes.
You were you were eating lamb vindaloo.
It was lamb vindaloo. I was a Jedi. I was dressed like a Jedi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was lamb vindaloo. That was
Brian
the...
Stack did a voiceover as the lamb vindaloo and
so
said, join
ridiculous.
Me or I will give you diarrhea. And I did I was going for the Mark Hamill Empire Strikes Back.
No!
that one. I did my best Hamill. God, that was dumb. You liked that one?
I loved it.
You just went down a peg.
Oh.
Well, look.
Listen to it. It was funny. It was very
There'll
funny.
Be other pegs you'll drop down when you hear
I gotta
his other
show
favorite
my
ideas.
Other. Oh, wait. More bullet? We're doing
yeah,
bullets
Yeah, the
now?
Other guys. Your part of the other guys was super hilarious.
Thank you.
I saw it, and every line you had like went over big. The sort of nebbishy.
I played Bob Littleford in the other guys. The character's name was originally Bob Delaney. There's a game that Adam McKay loves to play of incorporating obscure sports names into his work.
Yeah.
And you may know referee Bob Delaney, veteran referee from the NBA.
I do not know.
But that didn't fly. Someone somewhere in a leather chair,
yes.
decided my name shall be Bob Littleford.
Well, you're super funny in
Well,
that.
You did get to play Father Delaney on Damages, though. Recently.
That wasn't me.
That wasn't you?
I imagine it was a real – it's on my IMDb page,
yeah.
which I have no control over.
Huh.
I was not on Damages.
That, really? That,
you know how you put those little lies on your resume?
Yeah.
That's like an electronic lie on my IMDb page.
That's
that I
odd.
Can't get it off. I can't make it go away.
That's weird.
I think it must have been a real priest named Michael Delaney who was in Damages because he's not credited anywhere. It just deferred to my IMDb page.
Totally.
You were,
so of my big bullet points, that's it? Father Delaney
that's
on
it.
Damages?
Yes,
I got more. You were the plant in the...
I was just going to mention
that.
Yeah.
You say it.
That you were the plant in Will Ferrell's show.
You're welcome, America.
You're welcome, America. Yeah.
I deceived a Broadway audience
yes.
night after night.
That's right. You were what John
plant.
Glazer was to Pinata Full of Bees. You were the audience plant that George Bush
yeah.
throws out of the audience. And yeah. you throw a shoe at the president.
Yeah, wouldn't you know, I get in a Broadway show, and I have to sit in the house.
Yeah.
I didn't even get to go on stage.
That's right.
No, one night, we changed the blocking one night. We did this whole crazy thing, and I had to go on stage and dance.
Oh,
and
right.
I hated it a lot. We did it one night. And Adam's thing is, if it doesn't work, you just get rid of it and do
yeah.
something else. So we just cut it.
Mm-hmm. You were in Big Lake. You were the mayor
That's
in
true.
Big Lake.
Yes.
That's right. Very funny.
You guys are running out of bullets.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
I know what they are, but I'm challenging
terrible,
you now, Will.
Terrible.
Wait, what was that? You challenged me to something a while ago, and then you never came forth with what exactly the challenge was.
How can somebody make the extra pass without being aimless? How do you get a student to both... And then you guys said it was talented and shut up, Will Hines.
No, I was being facetious when I said be talented. I think we did address it after that.
It was a vague question.
Yeah, gee, what else have I done?
You were in the UCB show a lot, the UCB's TV show a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, we all did all. Everybody pitched in on
Head
that.
Head writer of The Edge with Jake Sasville.
That's right.
You wrote for the Onion News Network?
I was one of the
original,
writers
of the Onion News Network. Yes. And you did the Lost and Found guy.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Super funny bit.
I did create my own show. I have my own web show. National Lost and Found. It is a Lost and Found for the entire nation.
Yeah, yeah. Super funny.
Yes.
Yeah. Keys time.
A few really great sketches on Demetri Martin's show.
Right.
You did a few good sketches there.
And Demetri Martin used your phone number in a bit, which...
I still get phone calls.
Yes.
Well, he used my phone number in a bit that ended up on YouTube, and I started getting all these phone calls from bored hipsters.
Yeah.
It was getting really annoying, and I found his email somewhere, and I asked, hey, can you do something about this? And he emailed me back. He said, I really don't know, but I really want you to do some bits on my show. He said, I've been meaning to call you. Like, I actually need your number. And and then he put me in his show. They gave me a few contracts for that show, and then I couldn't complain anymore. So then every time I got one of those calls, it was like, meh, well, he took care of me.
Yeah, he got some work.
I started answering my phone loser hotline. Because if it's a Wisconsin call, I knew who it was.
Like somebody calling the Demetri number.
A bored teenager.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not professional, but you were in one of my favorite sketch shows on the UCB stage, Marooned.
Oh, yeah.
Which I talk to you about all the time, and I love that show.
Delaney and Dave. That was my favorite show, too.
Oh, good.
To ever have done in my life.
Marooned, I loved it.
Marooned was the best.
The stagecraft that you did in that show with the astronauts floating behind the window and all the...
Cosmonauts.
The cosmonauts, right, yeah.
Thank you, John. Yeah, that was
constructed like a Harold, right? That sketch show was sort of loosely constructed.
Yes,
like
it
a Harold.
Was. As a matter of fact, there was three different running stories. They didn't intersect as much as we would have liked, but you got to be true to the thing. If the connections are there, make the connection. There was a little bit of connections, but probably not enough. But they
held
up. One
of my favorite lines
in
that show is when your character is dead at the end, floating through space as a dead body, and Blumenfeld, in recording his log, says, "Once again, I am the sole survivor."
I forgot all about that.
He's on these missions where everybody's dead but him.
Oh, Dave. His subtext and his backstory.
So funny.
We won the New York City Nightlife Award that year.
Oh, congratulations.
That was many years ago.
Yeah, still.
You also gave me my first break as a tech person. I teched Bobby Curious's... Evil Knievel show.
I feel so guilty for not remembering who teched what shows.
You're good with faces and bad with names in
terrible.
My experience.
I still way too often have his Delivery Boy song stuck in my head. Way too often.
Oh, yeah, Delivery Boy. Yeah.
That was a great show.
That was a fun show.
Really fun, yeah.
You were in 90 of the top 100 funny scenes ever to happen in the UCB stage, probably. That's
probably,
a bullet point.
Yeah.
I think in the official countdown, I think.
Yeah, we're doing a Talking Head countdown show next week. Any other notable bullet points that we're skipping over?
There are, but I don't think about the past all that.
That's all I do.
Transplant patients don't. Actually, I do kind of live in the past, but not like trying to relive glories. It's always some strange.
Trent, you're in the moment
thing.
Because like
transplant patients always live in the moment. Yeah, just like actors should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, be in the moment. Right.
I don't know.
Because it can all go to shit immediately.
Yeah.
See, when you're a transplant, you're reminded of that. But that's true for all of us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I'm always like, oh, everyone's going to outlive me. No. I mean, no.
Right.
I'm going to outlive a lot of people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, a lot of people I know won't make it as far as I will.
Mm. So being in one of your classes, you'll say something like that, be like, okay, two more up, and your suggestion is...
Is that daunting? Is that
yeah, turtle out? Wax. No, I'm only kidding. Well, you'll say something like, the lyricism is in the undiscovered, not the discovered. Okay, two up, and your suggestion is end table. It's like, I don't know. That's
a good one, Will. The lyricism is in the undiscovered.
I think you said it. I think I'm quoting something you said like
No, I don't think so. I think you just created a new thing that was an amalgam of this, of some of the ideas in this conversation.
So I did have one other question that I wanted to ask you. You had talked about the approaching improv with a new freshness every time. How do you, and if so, how do you translate that attitude and approach to the written work that you've done, like the movie roles that you've done and Will Ferrell's play, etc.
Yeah, no, I think that applies to the written word almost equally. And I think it comes from preparation. Discipline is freedom. Mm-hmm. If you really, really know your lines and you know what you're about, you know, if you know the shot, if you know what the piece is about, and you've done your preparation and you've done your work, it gives you this freedom to wait for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't in my spare or in my own time write alternate lines, but I want to improvise and I like when things get spontaneous. But it's really about, like, the more confident I am about the line as written, the more freedom that gives me to go off of it. More importantly, just know what the scene's really about, and have your characterization.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have your characterization, then it's all about the moment, because I got to wait and see what the other actor is going to do.
Sure.
And it comes off that. So I've got to improvise quite a bit on screen, especially in the Conan show. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of times, many, many times, there was no script, especially for the pre-tapes, like we're doing satellite channels and things like that, where, you know, if you were really clear on what the game was, again, I wouldn't, like, come up with bits and write bits on my own. They'd always happen while the camera was running, depending on what was going on with my scene partner.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And in moments where maybe you're not improvising, you're just saying the lines, is a similar kind of thing of, like, see what your scene partner is giving you in terms of how you deliver the lines and how you approach that character.
Oh, also for myself, I don't practice my lines out loud.
Okay.
No, I memorize them,
mm-hmm.
make sure I have them down.
Sure.
I say them out loud to make sure that my pronunciation is right, but I don't interpret them. So if I'm at home, like laying in bed doing memorization, I may say, you know, just for myself, I'll say the words out loud, pretty much in a blank monotone, and think about what my intentions are, make choices. I'll make intellectual choices, but I don't know how it's going to come out until I get on set.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
It's much funner. It's yeah. Much funner.
Sure, and that's how you, that would, I would say that would optimize that freshness of...
It works for me, mm-hmm. you know, other different actors work differently. That's what works for me.
Sure.
I'm not really sure quite how it's going to come out. And that's nice, because more often than not, the first take is usually the cherry. Now, if I'm doing take after take at home and trying to nail down how I'm going to do it,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that is kind of lost. And it's a stinker when something happens that often first takes aren't usable for just logistical things, or the blocking wasn't just right or something. And it's like, oh, that's why I try to be as prepared as possible to try to really get it on that first take, especially if it's a small thing. If mm-hmm. it's a little one, first take is really often where it's at.
Yeah.
Love it. And luckily, those Conan writers are pretty, pretty badass guys. And then I remember doing a McCann piece, and we did it, and the first take was really good. And he was like, okay, yeah. Like, we're going to do a safety, right? He's like, no. Okay. It was like a 30-second job.
Yeah.
Discipline is freedom, John.
Okay, thank you.
That's chapter 2 of 1984. Discipline is freedom.
Oh, shoot.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
I am Big Brother.
Freedom, yeah.
Delaney, you have become the UCB's Big Brother.
Room 101.
So your classes now involve putting a rat cage on the first place.
Okay, should we wrap it up?
Is that it? Anything you
No,
had?
I feel pretty good.
Yeah.
I like it. We got into some nerd stuff.
It's only 3 hours.
We
should wrap it up.
I think this is a great way to kick off the new year of consistent UCB podcast.
And definitely.
Thank you guys for having me on your
Christmas
show.
We will we'll date this one, the Christmas show, so that it seems like it came out on Christmas.
So we're going to try to be back every week now, right?
Yes, so we will be back. We're not going to try, because try leaves the door open to not doing it.
I see.
So we'll just be here Thursday.
No, delay. We'll get back. We don't need you every...
Oh, I thought I was part of the...
Let's talk about this off the air, maybe?
Yeah.
Mm. Could you and I have Will on as a guest?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, but you're not going to be... You're not part of the cast of the show.
I mean, well, things change. Things necessarily
they could change.
We'll talk about it after the recording.
I think, Will, I think Delaney just successfully edged you out of this podcast.
It'd be hilarious, and I would let it happen.
So, John, let's wrap it up.
Sure. All right. All right.
Thanks to Will Hines.
Thank you, Will. Thanks for coming by. You can see Will on willhines.net every week.
nice to have been right?
And he's also on the Stepfathers. You can see him.
Oh, yeah.
On Fridays. Yeah. And look for Will's book that he co-wrote with Rob Lathan, Get Psyched.
Get Psyched.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a great book.
It's out there.
He's got a lot of other button points, too.
I'm not the guest, though. Just to
remember. You make a lot of videos, too, for UCB Comedy,
yeah,
right?
That happens,
yeah, sorry that we didn't get into any of those, but you can see them
guest,
online.
So it doesn't matter.
And this has been
the UCB Theater Podcast. Thank you very much, Delaney, for doing a great job co-hosting.
Thank you, John, and I'll see you next time.
Yeah, see you next week.
Okay.
Okay, bye, everybody.
Bye.